the name computational alchemy has become popular for these kinds of methods because you really are, in these calculations, changing one kind of element into another type of element. And so what I would like to do in the next few years with my research co-workers is to try to move the next level up and to go from computational molecular biology, if you will, to computational cellular biology. I think computational cell biology, founded on truly molecular understanding, could be one of the tremendous exciting areas of science in the early 21st century.
Scientist Andrew McCammon of the University of California. He'll be back in just a moment with more about cutting-edge research, information technology, and American education. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Although the importance of computers in American mass culture of the 1990s is undeniable, it's noteworthy that many of us still aren't fully comfortable with the language of cyberspace. But it's a vocabulary that's being quietly demystified almost daily on fronts ranging from high-tech research to business and education. One of the leaders in this effort is also one of the country's premier historians of the information revolution. David K. Allison is chairman of the Information Technology and Society Group at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. For the Smithsonian Institution, he supervises the museum's Information Age exhibit, a 14,000-square-foot display chronicling the history of information technology from the telegraph to today's latest computers. David Allison is also the Chief Smithsonian Officer for the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program. These awards recognize achievements in leadership and innovation in the workplace, the arts and sciences, and in the community. Here's David K. Allison.
Well, there really are two parts to the awards. One, as you mentioned, are the leadership awards, which recognize individuals in five different areas. Mm-hmm. And then there are 10 awards in different categories. Let's talk about the leadership awards first. Leadership awards are in the area of lifetime achievement, one or two people who've made continuing contributions throughout their whole career. There's a leadership award in the area of innovation in information technology, changes in computer technology, and so on. There's a leadership award in breakthrough computational science, how supercomputers or the large mainframe computers are changing major areas of our society. There's one on global integration. We all know how the world is coming together through information technology. This award recognizes an individual who's truly making a difference there. And finally, and most importantly from the Smithsonian standpoint, there's a leadership award in education, looking at how an individual is changing education through the use of information technology.
All right, now our conversation, David Allison, will focus on the question of computers and education, but quickly give me a sense of, with respect to these other four areas that you have mentioned, give me a concrete sense of somebody who has done or is doing what you view as breakthrough work.
Our award winner in this area this year was a man named Andrew McCammon, who's out in California, and is using supercomputers to design new pharmaceuticals, new ways that drugs can be made, can be synthesized, through understanding the most basic interactions at the molecular and submolecular level.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Professor McCammon. He gives us, we've got a sound clip here where he describes the kind of work that he's engaged in.
It's not something you can do in the laboratory, but because we're using computer models, because we're using mathematical representations of these systems, it's perfectly possible to take one of these computer simulations and just slowly change the size of atoms, change the lengths of chemical bonds, and actually transform, or I guess in modern parlance, to morph one molecule into another molecule and calculate the thermodynamic changes associated with that. What we really want, in some sense, is not to answer the question, how strongly does a potential drug molecule bind to a target, but what binds better, this drug or this other possible drug? We want to put things on a scale of relative binding strengths. And it occurred to me that you could start with our drug molecule bound to the active site of the enzyme and simply change it from one drug molecule into another one while it's located in the binding site. So, for example, we could take a hydrogen atom on a drug and slowly change it into a fluorine atom. The name computational alchemy has become popular for these kinds of methods because you really are, in these calculations, changing one kind of element into another type of element. And so what I would like to do in the next few years with my research coworkers is to try to move the next level up and to go from computational molecular biology, if you will, to computational cellular biology. I think computational cell biology, founded on truly molecular understanding, could be one of the tremendous exciting areas of science in the early 21st century.
Wayne, that was Andrew McCammon. One of the things that really is striking about him is not only is he a great researcher, but he's also a great teacher. He has a research institute where he brings young students along and teaches them the things that he's learned and prepares them for making further breakthroughs in the future.
David Allison, we're talking about the information revolution. You are the A curator of Computers, Information, and Society at the Smithsonian Institution. Before we turn to education and computers, I'm going to look at you sort of wide-eyed. How in the world does a professional historian come to a term like the information revolution? Just how much of our landscape are we talking about here?
Well, of course, having the portfolio of being the curator of Computers, Information, and Society is a pretty wide area of interest. Almost anything around us today is touched by computers in some way, whether that's banking or education, which we'll be talking about more later, finance, manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So the responsibility that I have at the Smithsonian is quite broad. The background that I bring to that is a degree in the history of science and technology and a great interest in how science and technology is changing our society.
You wrote a book about radar, didn't you?
I did.
Uh-huh. And the Navy.
Yes, I did. Uh-huh. We call that New Eye for the Navy. It's a good example of how the military was changed in the 1920s and the 1930s by the application of new areas of technology. World War II would have been a very different war had it not been for radar. Uh-huh. So you began to see a revolution in the military that later, through other electronics, particularly the digital computer, would change all of our society in the years since World War II.
How old are computers, David Allison? I mean, we hear stories about, you know, the Chinese having, what's the proper pronunciation here, an abacus, an abacus, and then we move into the 1990s with devices that store all the world's knowledge. I mean, really, how far back do we go?
Computers have their roots in mechanical aids to computation. So the abacus, later calculating machines, mechanical devices, slide rules, all kinds of mechanical aids to computation developed from the earliest eras of civilization. You could even say a stone tablet that you make marks on is in some ways is an aid to computation. Mm-hmm. But as that tradition goes forward, first in mechanical devices developing broadly in the 19th century, and then electronic devices, which began with a telegraph but grew into the area of computation with the coming of the digital computer in World War II, those electronic aids are what truly have changed our society.
How do you organize all of the information and, again, the documents, the artifacts that you deal with at the Smithsonian? Are you the first filter or the final filter here?
Well, we at the Smithsonian are really a fairly small organization. So in the area of computers, information, and society, there are about three or four of us that work together as a team mm-hmm. to determine what we're going to save and what we aren't. Our collection includes not only artifacts, it's primarily artifacts, really the physical things, the computers, printers, calculating machines, all the physical attributes of what's happening in information technology, but also written documentation, manuals, letters, correspondence, and all kinds of written material. Increasingly, it's becoming also electronic material.
Mm-hmm. Do you go out and get this stuff, or do people send it to you? I'm curious. I mean, what's the phrase? The Smithsonian is the nation's attic.
It's a real mixture, Wayne. We have people that will call us up and say, I have this old computer. Do you want it? Uh-huh. We also target people that we will go out and collect their material. For example, several years ago, mm-hmm. I made a collecting trip down to Federal Express. There's a good example of a company that couldn't exist without information technology. Right. We went in and documented how they develop and how they do their work through information technology and brought the representative pieces to the collection of the Smithsonian.
And just as a footnote to our conversation, David, give me the exact title of the exhibit for which you acted as the curator. This is an ongoing permanent exhibit up there at the American Museum of History, am I right?
Yes, the leading exhibit on this subject is called Information Age, People, Information, and Technology. It's a 14,000-square-foot exhibit at the National Museum of American History on the Mall in Washington, and it looks at the history of information technology from the telegraph to the present, focusing not so much on the technology itself, but on the interaction of that technology and our society.
Mm-hmm. Again, as a footnote to our conversation, because we're filling in a lot of gaps here for people who are familiar with computers and yet may not know all of the vocabulary. When you speak of interactive, David, what exactly does that entail?
When we speak of an interactive exhibition, such as Information Age at the Smithsonian, we're talking about an exhibit with which you can have a conversation, an exhibit that has devices that you can touch, get answers, get information that you seek, not information that we just put there. So at the Smithsonian, in this exhibition, there are a number of places that you can select specific video clips related to the exhibits that are around you. There are also a number of touchscreen computers where you can tell us in the exhibit a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you're from, and then get specialized information personalized to you that comes back. Throughout the whole exhibit, we have a local area network that keeps track of what you're doing, and when you leave, you can get a printout that details your experience with us.
Mm-hmm. Now, before, again, David Allison, we turn our conversation to computers and education, let me be contentious for just a moment here. How do you make the kinds of decisions about the work that you do as a curator at the Smithsonian and as a historian of science and computers, information technology, where you really are both serving the interests of the popular audiences that you deal with up there, and at the same time maintaining a strong sense of intellectual vigor and rigor so that you get into these interpretive struggles, do you not?
It is a difficult decision to make just how we spend our time, the kinds of things that we will collect, the kinds of things that we can't afford to collect, we don't have the space to collect. The only way I know to do that rationally, Wayne, is to have a series of people that work together with us. Mm-hmm. So none of us relies solely on our own particular predilections or interests. We have internal committees and review groups in the Smithsonian that oversee what we're collecting and what we aren't collecting. We have outside advisors that work together with us. When we mm-hmm. do major exhibitions, we have review committees that come and oversee what we're doing. We talk together with the industry. The Computer World Smithsonian Awards is a good example of that. Here we have a program where the people that make the judgments about what are the most outstanding technologies are not ourselves or Computer World. They're independent individuals from society that look at each category and tell us what they think.
David Allison, again, you are from the Smithsonian Institution, and we're talking about the Computer World Smithsonian Awards program. Let's turn our conversation to the question of education and computers. You have given me a sense that there is a kind of disparity here, that education, and in fact, is lagging behind when we speak of progress in information technology. Fill that in for me.
Wayne, I think that if you go today into the offices around us, the workplaces, you'd find that if you were somebody from the 1950s, you'd walk into the offices of today and you wouldn't know what to do. There are computers everywhere, there are new systems, there are new technologies. You would be completely at a loss at how to function in that office. Mm-hmm. And yet if you're a student from the 1950s and you walk into the classroom of today, in most places, you'd be right at home. The same lectures, the same course material. The topics may be somewhat different, but the style and the approach hasn't changed too much in most places.
All right, and you find in this what, some cause for alarm?
Well, I think it is a cause for concern, because if the classroom is preparing people to go out into the workplace and be successful, then the classroom has to change to be more like the world. In fact, in many ways, to lead what's going on mm-hmm. in the workplace rather than to lag behind it.
Well, give me a sense, David, historically of the relationship between education and technology. I mean, we joke about, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, and the blackboard and things like that. You're telling me that in educational terms, we're still way back there in, what, the 20s, 30s, 40s? Hardly even entered the 70s or 80s yet.
Well, I think that things are beginning to change in some places, and we can see those trends. But until education changes, then the rest of society really can't move along as fast as it should.
Does this mean simply throwing money at the schools in order that the kids can have a lot of computers to sit in? I don't want to be disrespectful, but, you know, the way they talk about it, I'm going to play with the computers today.
I don't think that technology or throwing money at the problem is really the answer. Mm-hmm. The answer is understanding what's going on and what should be going on. Let's go back historically for a minute and look at something from an earlier time period. In the middle of the 19th century, the modern university system, the one that we know today, began in Germany. It began through a new understanding of how science and technology related to learning, the coming of the disciplines, the coming of majors, the coming of concentrations in certain areas, the coming of advanced degrees. That slowly developed in education. It didn't come to the United States until later than in Germany. It came in the late 19th century, and by the early 20th century, you had modern universities that were taking over from the old colleges and earlier forms of education. And an understanding of science and technology and its role was at the foundation of that transformation.
Well, you could hardly avoid it because, I mean, this is the transitional period in which we're talking about the rise of what we call modern science and the secularization of knowledge.
Well, the surprising thing was how long, in fact, colleges and universities in this country did avoid many of those things and slow down the adaptation in the educational institutions. Uh-huh. What's happening today is a brand new relationship between students and information in society, current information, information about how things work and what's going on in the world around them. The educational establishments have to be caught up with that development of information and leading students into the tools of tomorrow to prepare them for going out in that workplace.
Give me a sense, David, of some of the breakthrough areas. That is to say, when we speak of the meeting ground between education and computers, in our contemporary American educational scene, elementary school, colleges, high schools, where is the exciting work being done? What does it involve?
I think what's happening with computers and education is that there's been a fundamental change. A few years ago, to learn about computers in school meant learning computer skills. How do you program in BASIC? How do you use a keyboard? How do you word process faster? Increasingly, that's not the focus. Increasingly, computers are becoming not something for learning skills, but something for accessing information, up-to-date information, specialized information. So you use the computer as a window onto a much larger world than what can be contained in your own educational institution.
What about the element of technical sophistication? You are sitting here across the table looking at somebody who is just barely out of the gate in terms of computer literacy. That is something that I feel there's a lot of pangs involved. You know, I want to get up to speed. Is there a way to get around, for lack of a better term, what I think of as computer anxiety when we put them in the schools?
The real mark of progress in the area of computers and education is when users have to learn not more and more technical understanding, but less and less. Mm-hmm. What should be happening and what will be happening for students is they'll come in and the basic skills that they need to access information will become less demanding, not more demanding. They'll be able to go into classrooms and point and click, use graphic interfaces, use very basic techniques to get access to the information that they need. Think about the automobile. The automobile initially was something for hobbyists. You had to go out and crank it up. You had to know how to set the spark gap. You had to know a whole lot of different techniques. Today, you go in and stick the key in and turn on the automobile. You don't even have to know how to change the gears, really, except to put it in drive or in reverse. The same thing will happen to computers as they become more technically sophisticated. That sophistication will be used to bring user demands lower, not higher.
David, let's listen, apropos of our conversation now about computers and education, to Leslie Maltz. Leslie is on the faculty at the Stevens Institute of Technology, and she was one of the finalists in this year's Computer World Smithsonian Awards. Tell me very quickly about what she's doing at Stevens.
Wayne, Stevens is an interesting school in that they require every student who comes there to have a personal computer. They've done this for many years. Leslie is the person who oversees this whole program and works to help computers become an integral part of student life.
Well, certainly the underlying principles are technological in that we are using the technology as part of the delivery of the education process. But it extends much beyond that in that we're using computers in the classroom, computers and networking to include discussions. We certainly are using worldwide library resources and databases for more than the scientific applications. We're very much oriented toward the humanities. It's an important part of our curriculum. All of our students are required to use computers as part of their humanities courses, which are included every semester. And we want to make sure that we're not producing the stereotype technical person who doesn't understand the world and only understands the technology. We want students who know how to use these tools in real-world problems. We will run workshops for those who are not technologically advanced because their high schools may not have had the facilities or their homes may not have had the facilities that we do on campus. And so we introduce them to using the technology in ways that they will find as supplemental to their educational process, as ways of using resources that the institution itself couldn't afford to have local on campus. We often will give assignments that require the students to use worldwide resources. We're extensively using libraries and have for almost 15 years now that are not necessarily within walking distance of the campus, because we want to make sure that our students know that this is how the rest of the world will be functioning by the time they graduate. We have to anticipate what their world will look like 4 or 5 years after they enter the college. And so we're trying to create that world from the freshman experience on.
How do you figure out what the curve is going to be like? In other words, how do you get a kid to live in the future when you're training them in the present?
Well, we very much try and create the future world today. Every year we go through an extensive evaluation, an extensive changing of our facilities on campus to make sure that what we're providing on campus in terms of resources for our students will be what they will see when they graduate 4 or 5 years later. Many are under a cooperative education plan. That's why I mentioned the 5 years later, because they're out there using these tools in professional positions throughout their academic career and learning how to use these things that will be the tools of the future. Often when they go out on their co-op assignments, they're teaching their employers what these tools are and leading them into the new technologies.
David Allison, we've just listened here to Leslie Maltz of the Stevens Institute of Technology. Again, let me be contentious with you. The kind of thing that's going on there, Leslie isn't here to attack or defend, but should we call this a form of educational elitism when we say that kids have to have computers and we're going to make, in other words, some tough decisions about who gets into a particular college on that basis?
I don't think so, Wayne. If you look at the price of a personal computer now, it gets down to a couple $1,000s, and you find if you price that against textbooks, you'll find that the costing is about the same. Mm-hmm. Increasingly, the computer is going to provide you access to worlds of information that you can't afford to get in a textbook form.
Well, what I'm doing here is exercising not only a bit of nostalgia, but what did they call them in the 19th century? The Luddites, the people who resisted technological progress. Are we, in fact, at a juncture in our culture where we simply have to, not surrender, but we have to, recognize the inevitability of what computers are and do?
I think we certainly have to look around at the workplace and understand the role that computer and information technology plays in the workplace and make sure that our students are prepared to live in that world. Having computers doesn't mean you throw away books, it doesn't mean you throw away teachers and throw away lectures, but it means that you acquaint students with a new tool that's essential to their world and essential to their life in the future.
Mm-hmm. Leslie Maltz, again from the Stevens Institute of Technology, speaks to those issues. Let's listen to Leslie.
The emphasis has really not been on the technology or the fiber in place. What we're trying to do is re-engineer how we teach. And so what we're doing is integrating the use of the tools, the use of the technology, into the teaching and learning process so that it's really transparent. But often it's not the case where the thing that we're trying to avoid is making the electronic textbook. There's nothing more boring than sitting and reading screens and screens that you could have picked up of Xerox paper or a book that someone has edited. We're trying to go away from that model and find the right ways to use the technology to enhance the learning process. One brief anecdote along that line is we often do the equivalent of exit interviews with our students and say, well, how did you enjoy using your computer? Do you think it was successful? And we've had a few students tell us, in fact, that they don't remember using the computer very much. But then they'll go on and tell us about all the things that they did, that they were accessing the World Wide Web, and they used the Library of Congress, and they've used this resource and that resource that were only accessible by using the computer. They don't think of it as technology, and they don't think of it as actually computing. They think of it as a resource at their fingertips.
David, we've just heard here from Leslie Maltz of the Stevens Institute of Technology. Let's use her comment by way of moving toward a conclusion of our conversation, this first portion of our conversation about computers and education. Again, fill me in on some of the vocabulary here. Implicit in what Leslie is talking about is the World Wide Web and the Internet. These are terms that people are only now becoming familiar with. Tell me about them.
Wayne, I think these two concepts are concepts that are going to become familiar to many people in the very near future, and let me try to explain them briefly. The Internet is really a series of computers and computer networks all around the world that are all linked together, and through an individual computer either at home or at work or at a university, you can log into this network and have immediate access to information on any of those computers throughout the world. Mm-hmm. The World Wide Web is one form of information that is exchanged across the Internet. Others are electronic mail, file transfers, but through the World Wide Web, you can get what's called a graphic interface to all this information. That means that on your computer screen, you can have things that look like magazine pages that mix together images and text, in some cases even video files and sound files. So you can, through a very simple way of clicking on information, jump from one computer to another and see what looks like a magazine page on your computer screen.
David K. Allison is chairman of the Information Technology and Society Group at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. He's also the chief curator of Information Age, an interactive and permanent display sponsored by the Smithsonian Institution. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. On this program, you also heard the voices of Leslie Maltz of the Stevens Institute of Technology and Andrew McCammon of the University of California at San Diego. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Cassette tapes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 779. That's $10, program number 779. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week, part two of Soundings on Information Technology and Education. Along with David Allison of the Smithsonian Institution, you'll also hear from John Zebarth of the University of Illinois Supercomputing Center and from Linda Roberts of the Department of Education. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Information Technology and American Education, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for David Allison of the Smithsonian Institution. He'll be here to talk about how computers are changing America's educational landscape. He'll also discuss the Computer World Smithsonian Awards, which recognize leadership in information technology from science to business and education. Finally, you'll hear from Information Age innovators from the University of California and the Stevens Institute of Technology. Education and Information Technology, this week on Soundings.